Welcome to The Kink Wire, the interventional radiology podcast from SIR Publications. You can learn more on our website, sirweb.org/kinkwire. This episode provides audio abstracts of papers published in the February 2024 issue of SIR's Journal of Vascular and Interventional Radiology. You can find the full papers on jvir.org. My name is Manbir Singh Sandhu, and I'm your host for this episode.
Hello, my name is Hannah Curtis, and I am a third-year medical student at Loma Linda University School of Medicine. I will be reading the abstract titled Radiation Major Hepatectomy Using Ablative Dose Yttrium 90 Radioembolization in Patients with Hepatocellular Carcinoma 5 cm or Larger by Choi and colleagues. Purpose: to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of ablative radioembolization for large hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC, while preserving a small future liver remnant. Materials and methods: 25 patients with large HCC of greater than or equal to 5 cm requiring treatment for greater than 60% of the total liver volume and having well-preserved liver function were treated with ablative glass microsphere radioembolization at a single institution from January 2017 to December 2021. Radioembolization was performed with a mean absorbed dose of greater than 150 gray, and the future liver remnant per non-tumor liver volume was set at greater than 30%. Changes in liver function, adverse events, duration of response in a treated area, time to progression, and overall survival were retrospectively investigated. Results: the largest tumor diameter and planned dose per treated volume were 11.4 cm plus or minus 3.9 and 242.3 gray plus or minus 63.6, respectively. All patients remained at Child Pugh Class A for 90 days. No patient experienced grade 3 or 4 hyperbilirubinemia or new ascites. One patient developed radiation pneumonitis requiring transient steroid treatment. According to the post-treatment dosimetry, the tumorous and non-tumorous liver absorbed doses were 418.8 gray plus or minus 227.4 and 69.0 gray plus or minus 32.1, respectively. The median duration of response in a treated area and time to progression were 22.0 and 17.1 months, respectively. The five-year overall survival rate was 83.2%. Conclusions: ablative radioembolization of large HCC of greater than or equal to 5 cm can be performed safely and effectively in patients with preserved liver function when future liver remnant per non-tumor liver volume exceeds 30%.
Hello, my name is Tahi Kamaneni, and I'm a recent graduate of the American University of Antigua College of Medicine and a practicing family law attorney. I will be reading the abstract titled Yttrium 90 Transarterial Radioembolization of Primary Lung Cancer Metastasis to the Liver by Alexander and colleagues. Purpose: to assess whether yttrium 90 transarterial radioembolization, or TARE, is safe and effective in the treatment of primary lung cancer metastasis to the liver. Materials and methods: this retrospective study included 57 patients with primary lung cancer metastasis to the liver who were treated with 79 TARE treatments. Histology included non-small cell lung cancer, small cell lung cancer, and lung carcinoid. Survival was calculated using Kaplan-Meier method. Differences between groups were estimated using log rank test. Cox proportional hazards model was used to determine factors influencing survival. Adverse events were graded using the Society of Interventional Radiology adverse events classification. Results: median overall survival was as follows: non-small cell lung cancer, 8.3 months. Small cell lung cancer, 4.1 months, and lung carcinoid, 43.5 months. For non-small cell lung cancer, presence of bilobar disease, more than one tumor, and lobar treatment were negative predictors of overall survival. For small cell lung cancer, receipt of greater than two lines of chemotherapy, versus less than or equal to 2 lines was a negative predictor of overall survival. For lung carcinoid, tumor involvement of greater than 50% was a negative predictor of overall survival, with a p-value equal to 0.002. There were 11 of 79 severe or life-threatening adverse events within 30 days. Conclusions. TARE has an acceptable safety profile for the treatment of primary lung cancer metastasis to the liver, with survival benefits best seen in lung carcinoid tumors.
Hello, my name is Alina Khalil, and I'm a second-year medical student at Nova Southeastern University Dr. Kiran Patel College of Osteopathic Medicine. I will be reading the abstract titled Percutaneous Cryoablation of Recurrent or Oligometastatic Tumors in Thoracoabdominal Soft Tissues, Safety, Effectiveness, and Technical Aspects by Pasella and colleagues. Purpose: to assess the effectiveness and safety of cryoablation or CRA for the treatment of recurrent or oligometastatic solid tumors located in the thoracoabdominal soft tissues. Materials and methods. 22 percutaneous CRA procedures performed in 19 patients to treat recurrent or oligometastatic tumors in thoracoabdominal soft tissue were retrospectively examined. All procedures were performed between January 2015 and June 2021 under ultrasound and CT guidance, and the most complex procedures were performed with CT-based navigation systems. The histology of the primary tumors included colorectal adenocarcinoma, squamous cell lung carcinoma, pancreatic adenocarcinoma, renal cell carcinoma, and hepatocellular carcinoma. Adverse events, technical success, and local tumor control were analyzed. Results. The mean age of the patients was 66.5 years, with a mean tumor size of 24.8 millimeters. The mean time of the procedures was 68 minutes, with a mean number of 2.5 cryoprobes used. Hydrodissection was performed in 63% of the procedures to protect the surrounding anatomical structures. The mean size of the ice ball measured on axial CT scans at the end of the procedures was 43.5 millimeters. No severe adverse events were observed. Technical success was achieved in all cases. 3 patients experienced local tumor progression, which were successfully treated with a second CRA procedure. Conclusions: percutaneous CRA is a safe and effective therapy in selected cases of recurrent or oligometastatic tumors in the thoracoabdominal soft tissues.
Hello, my name is Dhanush Reddy, and I'm a postdoctoral research fellow at the Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston. I will be reading the abstract titled Targeted versus Empiric Embolization for Delayed Post-Pancreatectomy Hemorrhage, a Retrospective Study of 312 Patients, by Tan and colleagues. Purpose: to assess the safety and clinical effectiveness of empiric embolization compared with targeted embolization in the treatment of delayed post-pancreatectomy hemorrhage. Materials and methods. The data of patients with delayed post-pancreatectomy hemorrhage between January 2012 and August 2022 were analyzed retrospectively. In total, 312 consecutive patients, of which 239 were men, were included. The group was stratified into 3 cohorts according to angiographic results and treatment strategies, which are targeted embolization or TE group, empiric embolization or EE group, and no embolization or NE group. The chi-squared or Fisher exact test was implemented for comparing the clinical success and 30-day mortality. The variables related to clinical failure and 30-day mortality were identified by univariable and multivariable analyses. Results: clinical success of transcatheter arterial embolization was achieved in 70% of the patients who underwent embolization. There was no statistical difference in clinical success and 30-day mortality between the EE and the TE groups. Multivariate analysis demonstrated that malignant disease, grade C pancreatic fistula, intra-abdominal infection, and concurrent extraluminal and intraluminal hemorrhage were risk factors for clinical failure. Moreover, 13.6% of the patients died within 30 days after embolization. Advanced age and intra-abdominal infection were identified as risk factors for 30-day mortality. Conclusions: empiric embolization is safe and as effective as targeted embolization in preventing rebleeding and mortality in patients with angiographically negative delayed post-pancreatectomy hemorrhage.
Hello, my name is Ashwin Mahendra, and I am a third-year medical student at Florida Atlantic University's Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine. I'll be reading the abstract titled Early Outcomes of Interwoven Nitinol Wire Stent Placement versus Endarterectomy for the Treatment of Atherosclerotic Disease of the Common Femoral Artery by Allen and colleagues. Purpose: to compare the clinical outcomes of common femoral artery atherosclerotic disease treated with either surgical endarterectomy or an interwoven nitinol wire stent system. Materials and methods: a retrospective review was conducted of all patients with chronic de novo atherosclerotic common femoral artery disease treated with surgical endarterectomy or stent placement between July 2019 and March 2022. Outcome measures assessed up to 12 months after procedure included clinical improvement, primary restenosis, target vessel revascularization, major adverse limb events, and all-cause mortality. Results: 39 stents were deployed in 33 patients, and 56 common femoral artery endarterectomies were performed in 55 patients. No differences were noted in the rate of primary patency, target vessel revascularization, major adverse limb events, and all-cause mortality between the stent and surgical endarterectomy groups up to 12 months after procedure. There was greater improvement in median clinical severity in the stent group than in the surgical endarterectomy group. The median length of stay was less for the stent group, 3 versus 7 days, with a p-value of 0.002, and there was a lower likelihood of severe or disabling adverse events in the stent group. Conclusions: patients treated with an interwoven nitinol wire stent had patency rates comparable to those treated with common femoral artery endarterectomy, while having a lower incidence of severe adverse events and a shorter length of hospital stay than those who underwent surgical endarterectomy.
Hello, my name is Dr. Jeremy Brown, and I am a transitional year resident at Kauai Health Medical Center in Visalia, California. I will be reading the abstract titled Percutaneous Deep Venous Arterialization in Patients with No Option Critical Limb Ischemia, Performed in an Office-Based Laboratory Setting, by Sean Mugusandaram and colleagues. Purpose: to evaluate the feasibility and safety of percutaneous deep venous arterialization, or PDVA, performed in an office-based laboratory, or OBL, for patients with no option critical limb ischemia, or CLI. Materials and methods: a retrospective chart review was performed on all patients who underwent PDVA using commercially available devices from January 2018 to November 2021 in a single OBL. In total, 22 patients, 10 males and 12 females, all of Rutherford grades 4, 5, and 6, were identified with a median follow-up of 140 days. Amputation-free survival, wound healing, PDVA patency, and overall survival were evaluated at 30 days, 6 months, and throughout the remaining follow-up period. Results: all patients had undergone failed previous attempts at endovascular arterial reconstruction. At 6 months after procedure, 6.4% of arteriovenous conduits remained patent. 83.3% of patients experienced complete or partial wound healing. In addition, 78.6% of patients avoided an above ankle amputation, and overall survival was 83.6%. 9 patients underwent endovascular reinterventions at 6 months. 1 mild adverse event and 4 moderate adverse events occurred after procedure, and 1 cardiac death occurred 5 days after procedure. Conclusions: percutaneous deep venous arterialization is safe and feasible in the office-based laboratory for patients with no option critical limb ischemia. Many patients avoided an above ankle amputation during the study period, despite low overall PDVA patency.
Hello, my name is Isabel Barbosa, and I am a third-year medical student at the Frank H. Netter MD School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University. I will be reading the abstract titled Geospatial and Socioeconomic Disparities in Access to IR Care in the United States by Ahmad and colleagues. Purpose: to determine and analyze the geographic distribution of interventional radiologists in the United States to identify populations with decreased accessibility to interventional radiology care. Materials and methods: the Society of Interventional Radiology public database was reviewed for practicing interventional radiologists in all cities within the United States. U.S. Census data were used to acquire county-level data sets on poverty, population, unemployment, median household income, education, and racial diversity. Odds ratios were calculated for access to interventional radiology care between the 75th and 25th percentiles for each population variable. Counties with interventional radiologists were compared with those without, for each variable using t-test. Quantum Geographic Information System was used to map the distribution of interventional radiologists. Results. A total of 2,989 U.S. interventional radiologists were found to be operating in 15.5% of all counties. Almost one-third of the country's population did not have access to an interventional radiologist within their county. The mean interventional radiologist to population ratio was 0.305 per 100,000 people. The mean median income among counties with interventional radiologists was greater at $67,649, compared with $53,528 among counties without, with a p-value less than 0.05. In addition, a mean of 31.3% of the population had a college degree in counties with interventional radiologists versus 20.3% in other counties, with a p-value less than 0.001. Higher mean percentages of African Americans, Pacific Islanders, and Hispanics were observed in counties with interventional radiologists at 13.1%, 0.232%, and 13.7%, respectively, with a p-value less than 0.05. Conclusions. Interventional radiologists are disproportionately distributed with higher densities of radiologists practicing near urban areas. Access is also limited to counties with higher incomes and a greater percentage of citizens with a college education.
We'd like to thank everyone who helped with this episode. My name is Manveer Singh Sandhu, and I'm a second-year medical student at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine, and I was your audio editor. You can visit jvir.org for the full papers, other audio content, and much more.